Well, good morning, everyone. Nice to be here, and thank you all very much for inviting us to come here. It's nice to be able to get back to this area, which sort of still feels a bit like home. This gathering is something that our families come to all of our life for the most part, and only missed it maybe last year. I'm not sure about the year before, but in a lot of ways, it's like coming back to see a lot of familiar faces. I missed Hanover last year, so that was not so good, or this past summer, and nice to be able to see you now. And it's fun to be able to be here. I realize that most of you didn't have any say in who the speaker was today, but whatever the committee, I thank the committee, because we'll sneak in and get some visits, see the granddaughter and all that. So it's a fun time for us. Some of you that are really into making PowerPoints will look up there and say, that's a terrible PowerPoint because it's got all too much stuff on the screen. But that was actually my view of Ecclesiastes most of my life, and that's why I threw that up there, sort of like a collage. Doing the Bible readings, a chapter at a time, reading one chapter like we just did right there. You read a chapter, and tomorrow you read another one, then another one. It's just, to me, like it was a bunch of scattered things. And it's always been something that puzzled me, because you know that Ecclesiastes was written by one of the wisest people who ever lived. And it can't be a bunch of scattered things. You know that from the start, but never took the time to actually look into it and try to figure out what's the strategy of the letter, what's actually holding it all together. It's a lot like reading the Proverbs. And I don't know if you've done that before, but when you're going through the Proverbs, you can either do them as read a chapter a day in the Bible readings, or you can try to figure out what's the strategy of the Proverbs. And people that have looked into Proverbs found out that, wow, there's actually themes running through Proverbs. They're not a bunch of scattered verses, written by, in a lot of ways, the same person who wrote Ecclesiastes. And I'm hoping this weekend that maybe what some of you can take home is the strategy of Ecclesiastes and try to read it a different way. That there really is a theme running through this book, and you'll see that as you go along. And it really follows Solomon's life. I really think it was written by Solomon. And he takes you back through what he did in his life. And he does that for all of the young people that are here, so that you can read Ecclesiastes now as a young person, and he saves you all the trouble of going through this yourself, so that you can hopefully take some of his wisdom with you home and realize, well, if you ever wondered what it would be like to do this, he's already been there, done that, and he'll tell you what happened. And he had more money, and he had more power, and more of everything than we will ever have to try it out. And he's tried it all. And then he tells us what he found out about trying it all. So I think it's fun to look at the book from that perspective, and I'm hoping this week, at least as today, this weekend, as we go through it, that you'll get a chance to pick up some of those things. So the strategy this weekend is going to be to just tackle this thing like one section at a time and go through it, and rather than, like other people have given classes on Ecclesiastes that I've listened to, and they sort of like pick a theme that they like, and they go through the book and look for that theme without actually following the strategy of, you know, why is that coming up? And I'd rather like look at how Solomon put it together and tackle it from that perspective. So that's pretty much the game plan for us for today. And I remember this gathering for years and coming here that it was always a long Saturday, because you guys pack it in. You start early in the morning, two classes before lunch, then two more classes, then the Bible readings, and then dinner. And then after eating all that good food, we had to go out and play volleyball and basketball in the gym. And by the time the day was over, it was like, wow, that was a long day. And now today we get to pack an extra hour in. Wasn't that nice of the government to change daylight savings time to this weekend? So that this is not only the longest day of your life, this is an extra hour. Oh, so we'll see. Anyways, hopefully if you like Ecclesiastes like I have, maybe the time will breeze by for you. But I found this is a really fun book to have a look at and try to figure out the strategy as we go along. So, some of the familiar verses that you probably know of, favorite sayings that you picked up in Ecclesiastes. As I was growing up, these were things I could do. Somebody could rattle off the first part, like we just did in chapter 1, that one generation goes and another generation comes, but, and then you know the rest, right? And we know these verses, and these are like common passages that we quote out of Ecclesiastes. And all my life I heard the eye is never satisfied with seeing, nor the ear with hearing, right? So we know the verses. But what I've discovered is that it's very difficult to find the context of the verses. When you talk to people, you can rattle off the passages, but then when you ask somebody, well, what did that verse mean within its context? That's a whole different story. Why did Solomon put that in there? Is it for the reason that we've been quoting it, or is it for something else? And that's the kind of thing that we want to look at today. We're going to try to pick up all these favorite passages we've had and try to figure out, well, what did they mean within the context? Have we really been faithful to the context, or does it really mean something else? And sometimes you may find you have been faithful. Sometimes you may find, whoa, had a little different meaning than I thought. Sort of like when you're reading James 4 and you find out that friendship with the world is enmity with God. And all of your life as a young person, adults were telling you that and telling you that meant, you know, you should be careful who your friends are. And then as you read the context, you find out, whoa, it doesn't mean that at all. It's about behaving like the world, and it was about adults who were misbehaving, not so much kids that were picking the wrong friends. And so this is the fun stuff about Bible study. When you get a weekend to do this, you get a whole day where you can focus in on Ecclesiastes. Hopefully we'll get a chance to have a look at these passages within their context and find out what they actually mean. The book of Ecclesiastes, the actual storyline as you go through it, it really does serve a purpose a lot like Job. You can see why it's in that same area in our Bible as the book of Job, because what Job did is Job illustrates that God's way is the right way to live no matter what happens in our life. Job went through that for us. He went through that for Jesus Christ, because no matter what people did to him, he could reflect back on what Job went through and realize whatever God puts us through in life is right for us. God's righteousness, that's what the book is really about. And it uses suffering as the means of developing that issue. But the primary reason of the book of Job isn't really suffering, even though that's the way it's remembered. It's more to do with the fact that does Job serve God for naught? And that was the original problem in the book of Job. Ecclesiastes is very similar to that, because what it's going to do is help us as we go through this realize the true happiness and satisfaction, or what he calls profit, as you're reading through this in chapter 1. What profit has it for this? What's the profit of this? And he keeps going through, what's the profit of that? And he looks at life from the perspective, well, what was the purpose? Why do we do it? What kind of satisfaction do you get? What's the profit? Well, he comes to realize as he's working through this that really true satisfaction and profit will only come when you fear God and keep his commandments and have the faith and the trust to believe and accept that whatever God brings into our life is right for us. Very similar to, in a sense, what Job went through. These are the common things that people become frustrated at in life. When events of life come on us, and all of a sudden we're struck with a disease, we're struck with a car accident, something happens in the ecclesia, and immediately our natural reaction is to stand back and say, wow, why did God do this to me? This isn't fair. This isn't right. And both of these books tackle this basic human problem of what do you do when God brings trouble into your life? How do you react? How do we handle this? And all the problems of life that we associate with. And what you'll find is that Ecclesiastes is a much broader one than Job. Job focuses specifically on suffering, whereas Ecclesiastes, it looks at a lot more of these issues, a much broader way. Now, Solomon, I think you'll find he was the author of the book. You can go back and check it out yourself. Maybe some of you have different opinions, but most people accept that Solomon was the author. And when you're going through it, especially when you get up to chapter 7 and you start seeing how he uses wisdom in chapter 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, you'll see that it's very similar to the Proverbs. You find it in chapter 1 that we just read in Ecclesiastes when it said that the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So we know that he's king in Jerusalem. We know that he's a son of David along those lines. And when you get down to verse 12 of the chapter that we just looked at, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Well, there really weren't very many kings who were king over Israel in Jerusalem. And that really does narrow it down. When you go back and look at it, you know, there was David and then Solomon and Rehoboam for a little while. So you're really down to just a few. The building projects that you look at in chapter 2, hopefully we get there at the end of this class, you'll find that Solomon was noted for those building projects. You'll find that he gained more wisdom than everybody that was before him, he says, in chapter 1, and you can certainly document that in the book of Kings. And by the way, for all of you that are madly copying down slides, we're going to probably go through them so fast that you're never going to get all this stuff down. So up here you will find a little thumb drive for all you technology people, and you're welcome to plug that into your laptop or have one of your friends do that, and you can have the PowerPoints that way. Or after the weekend's over, I'll probably go home. We're going to go back to Michigan for a while, and we'll upload these things to livoniatapes.com. So you can download the slides that way if you want and have the notes for the weekend. Because there's a lot to cover to try to get through all of this in just one weekend. You find that the wives that he had, the 1,000 wives that are mentioned, he talks about 1,000 women later on in this book, and in chapter 7, and it just throws that number out there. And we know that he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. The fact that he set in order many proverbs, you'll get to that in chapter 12 in the exhortation tomorrow, and you go back to 1 Kings 4 and you find out that's what he's noted for, putting together all those proverbs and all of his songs. And the fact that he actually uses phrases right out of the prayer that he made at the dedication of the temple, that's another interesting one that you can look at. But I think you'll find most people have accepted that Solomon was probably the author of this book. Nobody else really qualifies to do all those things. When you look at the unique characteristics that Solomon had as to why he could write this book and what brought him to this point, he had the power and he had the wisdom that God gave him. He gave him both, the power and the wisdom to experiment in life. Not that God had intended that he would necessarily, but that Solomon was given this, and then he sort of maybe came to believe like, well, God's given me all this, maybe I should try this out because nobody else can really do this. And so he did. And as he works through this, I think what he's left on record for all of us is if you're ever wondering what it would have been like to have this in life, if you ever wondered what it would have been like if you had been born into this royal family or if you had had this or that, Solomon's going to tell us all that, look, at he's been there, he's done that, and there's really nothing to it. It's all like striving after the wind. You're like grasping for something that really isn't there. Or what the Hebrew means, it's like feeding on the wind. It's like you think there's something that's feeding you in all this, and it's really, it's a bunch of nothing. It's like smoke that will blow away. And it doesn't really bring lasting happiness to people, lasting satisfaction. God gave him a wise and discerning mind. You find that in 1 Kings 3. That was one of the things God was willing to give him as a result of his prayer and what he asked for from God. God also offered him length of days in 1 Kings 3. Even though we know that Solomon died at 60, so he really didn't get, you know, what we would call a long life. I don't think most of us here at least consider 60 to be really length of days anymore. Maybe back then it was. I think David lasted till 70, but 60 really wasn't super long. But you look at Solomon, what he did, he may have been so busy all of his life. He seems to be the kind of person that was always working on projects. He was a busy, busy, busy man, thinking about all these things as he's going through it. Probably didn't sleep real well because he sat up at night. You'll see this as we're going along, and he knows what it's like to be worried and just stressed out over what you're going to do the next day and what's coming in life. He's been through that and done that. And it seems like in the end that he died at 60 as an old man who was like really worn out at that point. And when you get to chapter 12, God gave him wisdom, and he gave him very great discernment, like the breadth of mind, like the sand of the seashore. It actually uses that kind of an analogy there in 1 Kings 4. And he had the drive and the interest to search these things out. A lot of people wouldn't. Many of us sitting here today, if God had given you all these things, you might be very content to just go home and sit under your own vine and your own fig tree and plow your own little field and do whatever. But Solomon wasn't like that. He was driven to go out there and try this out. He just couldn't wait to get out there and see what he could do with all of this. And he maintained his wisdom. That's another thing that he actually says. And you may wonder, like, why does he keep saying that? Well, he's trying to remind us as he's going through his experiments. It's not like he got so lost in the experiment that he couldn't analyze it anymore. He's maintaining his wisdom and analyzing it as he goes along and finding out that it really didn't do what he had hoped it would do. It didn't bring him the satisfaction, the profit that he had hoped for. And he didn't have to worry about defending his kingdom because David had really given him rest all around. So David had set up this perfect scenario where he had conquered all the nations around and leaves Solomon with the work of building the temple and all this money coming in from all the different countries year after year. And he was a rich man, had lots of time on his hands to build, and he loved to build. He loved to go out there and do projects. So he goes out there and he runs the experiments for all of us. And fortunately, he's left that on record for us now. So why not listen to the guy who's probably one of the greatest wisdom people alive of all times as he teaches us about life? And this is the part of Ecclesiastes that I couldn't wait to actually do at some point in my life, is to get down and actually find out what is Solomon really trying to say. And I must confess, doing the Bible readings the way we do is a chapter a day and going through this for a long time, I just couldn't really put the themes together. But I really encourage you to have a look at them and read the chapters all at once, like read through the book as a book and try to remember what happened earlier and what goes on later and see it as a flow of somebody's life, because he really was one of the wisest people ever to live, and he had the power and he had the authority to actually try a lot of different things. So he's left these things on record for us. Now, when you look at what bothered Solomon, what kind of things was he worried about? Which may not be the same things you're worried about, but I think what he's done is left us with a record of some of the common things that human people worry about in life. These are typical human problems. Because all of you guys, especially the younger guys over there, they're just starting to go to work, and you're still in college now, or you haven't really had to go out and work and pay all the bills yet. Your day's coming, see? And when you do that, once you start that, and you have a family, and you have responsibilities, and a child comes along, and then you have more responsibilities, all of a sudden your life is taken over with work. And it's like we live with alarm clocks, and you get up in the morning, you go to work, and you work all this time. Or you're a farmer and you go out there and work, or whatever your job situation is. You go back and look at how much of our life is focused around our work, especially for the fellas that are here. And I think Solomon left this on record for a lot of you guys. Maybe some of the girls can associate with this today too, that you do all this hard work. You go out and you work day after day after day. What do you get for all that work? Well, you get to eat. Isn't it amazing how much time we spend working just so that we can eat? Some of us really enjoy eating. Some of us, that's why we came to the Couch Gathering all our life, is that there was breakfast in the morning, there was snacks in between every class. You know, this is the only time I got sauerkraut all year, back in the way back old days, right? Those days are gone. but that's what I remembered about this gathering. But I mean, this was like you eat all day long, and then you try to go out and run in the gym at night, and it was like, wow, what a setup for failure. Especially some of the guys we were trying to cover. Yeah. Anyways, but you wonder, like, Solomon looks at this issue. What do you get for all this work? What does it really accomplish for you? And as he's going through this, he starts out just looking at it from the perspective of a humanism person. Like, why are we doing all this? But what he's also doing is he's trying to figure out as he goes through this, why did God have us do this? Why is God doing this? It isn't just Solomon trying to figure it out from only a human perspective. He's actually got God in mind all the way through the book. And that I did not realize, I must say, over a number of years. I didn't figure out to what extent he had never lost touch with God all the way through this book. And you're going to see this as we go along. He's really frustrated in chapter 1 that there's really nothing new that you can really accomplish. And you might wonder today, like, well, you know, why would that matter so much? But you look at his life. Here he is, the king. He's inherited this whole kingdom that's huge. He's got all this money coming in and all this power. He's got a workforce of 180,000 people he can send out to do jobs for him. And he starts doing all this stuff and then realizes that, well, what can you really do with all of that? All I can do is build some buildings and put together projects and all that. And the next king who comes after me, that's really all he can do too. He can do it over again. He can fix and he can maintain some of the things I built. And he starts to realize how much it costs to actually maintain all this stuff that you put together. And Solomon goes through this thought process of like, what do we really get for all of this? You really can't make anything new. All these cycles. Now, he didn't grow up in a day and age where you have iPad 5 coming out or whatever, iPhone 5, and you got to have the newest, latest technology and line up at the store for all those kind of things. It was more back in the days of like when you look at life back then, it was a simpler kind of life. But even then, he found out really all you can do is make an upgrade on what the guy had before. You really can't do a lot of new stuff. He's frustrated as he goes through because he finds out that life seems unfair. You're going to see this come up a lot. This bothered Solomon a lot, that life seemed unfair. He watched in his kingdom and he saw righteous people suffering what he thought the wicked people should get. And righteous people, this is what they're going through. And he's figuring, how can this be right, that righteous are suffering what the wicked should get? Well, it's very similar to Job. You know, Job is one specific case. Solomon's going to be much broader. He looks out at government and societies today, in his day, and he realizes that many of the governments that he would have known, the nations around him, when people would come in and they'd talk to him, and different what folks would come and see his kingdom, and even saw within his own kingdom that there were times when people could be in charge and they would take advantage of the people. They weren't really being fair to the people, is what he would consider fairness in life. And he's frustrated over the unfair situations that people grow up in. You're going to see that he becomes very frustrated at the fact that whether you lead a righteous life or whether you choose a life of wickedness, all you get in the end is death. That bothered him a lot because that's not what he expected. He grew up sort of like viewing God in such a way as a young person, maybe as kids, when you grow up and you think you've heard all these different stories about how if you do good, you will be blessed, and if you don't do good, you will not be blessed. And you know, you read about Israel as a nation, that that's how God treated them. But what Solomon found out, and here he is judging his people, and he's hearing all these cases come in, and he hears all the things going on in his kingdom. And he finds out that, wow, no matter whether people are good or whether they were bad, all that happens in the end is you die. And that really bothered him, that why did God do that? That doesn't seem right, doesn't seem fair. You're going to find out there's an answer to that. But this is what he's tackling in his own mind. And he finds out, look, there may not be justice now. In this day and age, in your life right now, you may not get justice. And that's the way it goes. And he has to accept that and try to figure out, what is God doing with all this? That's what I find the fun part of this book. He thinks deeper than most of us do, and he tries to figure out, what is God doing with these things? Why did he make our world this way? And this is where you get into the wisdom of Solomon. He actually is a very deep thinker about all this and tries to figure out, what is God doing? Because from a human perspective, he's thinking, this isn't the way he would run it. This isn't the way he would run his kingdom. Why is God running life like this? He finds out that punishment isn't executed right away. People do bad things for a number of years, and they don't get punished for it. And it goes on. And then when you see that they don't get punished for it, what do you think? You think, all right, I can do it too, and I won't get punished for it either. And what that seems to do is multiply wickedness. People think they can get away with it. And that really bothered him. That it, like, why doesn't God just take care of it right away? And that other people he looked at, and he found out they were just workaholics. They just worked and they worked and they worked, almost not even like thinking about why they're doing it. They don't even think about why we do it. It was just like work, 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 work all the time. They worked and they worked and they worked. And whether it was try to get better than somebody else or improve on their neighbor out of envy of what somebody else had, he looks at those kind of issues. Why do people do this? And then he looks at the fact that as he's going through life, he realizes, and he probably saw this as folks came into him and talked to him and asked for judgments, he found out very few people are content with their life. Very few are content. Most people are just stressed out, workaholics, just going through life, wanting more, and it's just a frustration he ran into. Is that, why is it so hard to be content? And you'll see that. So he tries to analyze those things and figure them out as he's going along. Now, some of the key words you probably run into before as you're reading through this book, vanity. You look at vanity and you try to figure out, well, what in the world is he talking about with this vanity? And it seems to be that he's looking at life now without the perspective, not the perspective of without God. Oh, no. See, I ran into this of looking at other people's books and studies and things, and you wondered about it yourself. Did Solomon come at life from a perspective of thinking about, I'm going to go after all of this without God? Or is God really in the picture all the time? And what you will find consistently through this book is that he's always got God in mind. He's just trying to understand what God is doing. And I didn't understand that about Ecclesiastes for a long time. So when he uses vanity like that, what he's talking about is life now without the perspective of understanding what God's doing. You don't see it that way. Instead, you're just trying to look at it from our position up instead of from God down. And we try to figure out, like, how can this be fair? How can this be right? It's all a bunch of vanity. We're going through all these things. We work and work and work. And he's not understanding what God is doing with all of this. Why did God set it up this way? But he comes to find out as he's going through the book. That's the good part. If you stick with me today, I think you'll find he actually starts to uncover answers to his questions. The striving after the wind, or what the King James calls vexation of spirit, it actually is more like striving after wind. He sees it as though you're trying to catch the wind. You're like always grabbing at something that isn't, you can't get. You can't actually find that happiness, that satisfaction, that profit. The Hebrew word actually means to feed on. It's like feeding on the wind. It's like there's something that you're feeding on that isn't even there. It's a big smokescreen of life, and you think it's going to give you satisfaction and happiness, and when you finally you get it, you find out it doesn't. You're feeding on wind as you go through this. Under the sun, that phrase that comes up all over the place, this is not living life without God. Oh no, this is very clearly going to have God in it. But what it is, it's living life now as an end in itself. It's more like what we would call a humanistic approach. There are people today that are what we call, they're theistic humanists. They believe in God and they have a humanistic view of life. And this is what he sees in a sense that you're living your life now trying to figure out how is this all right for us, but God's still there in the picture, but you don't see it from in the fact that God is training you. Instead, you're trying to figure out how life is right, and yeah, there is a God, but you don't really see this God involved a whole lot, and it's life now under the sun. That's really what he sees. but he never really doubts the existence of God. You'll notice as we're going through the book, which I had never picked up on, all the times I'd read it, I must admit, I never really saw the fact that he changes once in a while from he and they to you. Now, I never picked that up before. He actually gets to points where he's going to get very personal. And he now, when you get to the you part, you know he's trying to talk to you. He's trying to get an exhortation across. And I didn't realize that even went on in this book, because it doesn't happen until chapter 5. That's the first time it appears, where all of a sudden he talks to you instead of they and he and all the third person stuff. Wisdom versus foolishness. Very similar to the Proverbs. You'll see that come up in this book all over the place. Wisdom versus foolishness. And I really think that what he's got in wisdom is the ability to apply perceptions that you might have, judgments, and all the actions based on a deep understanding of the situation. This is what we would call wisdom today. He had this from God. He had this ability to do this in a great extent. And he encourages all of us to seek after wisdom, to be able to do this, to try to analyze things like this from the perspective of God instead of just from a humanistic perspective. And he'll come to that when you get to chapter 7. All of a sudden, things change about wisdom. The prophet, what our Bible calls prophet, some of us, I know from the reading, whatever version we were using this morning, they think it's an advantage, but it's the same basic idea. He keeps saying, what profit is it if I do this? What's the profit of doing that? And I think what he's looking at is some kind of long-term satisfaction, trying to figure out, like, what is God after in all this? What happiness do you get? What gain do you get? What kind of long-term benefit is there to spending all this time on something? It would be very similar to what Jesus picks up in Matthew 16 when he talks about what profit is it to you if you gain the whole world and you lose your soul. And I think what Christ understood is he already knew what Solomon was trying to get to, and Jesus had it figured out. Because what is the profit of gaining the whole world? What is the profit of going after all the stuff of this life if you lose your own soul in the midst of it? Which was certainly a possibility, as you could see in Solomon, where he goes through this period where his wives turned away his heart. All these things he sought after, in the end, it was possible he could lose it all. And what profit is it then? In fact, Christ might have actually had him in mind when he actually said that, because what is the point of doing it and losing your own soul? He uses the word labor a lot, or work, you know, this idea of man's labor, and it really frustrated him that all this work that we do, day after day, what's the point of it all? And then you'll see that every so often he'll throw in words like, I know, I perceived, I saw, and you're getting a conclusion, or you're getting a personal experience that he witnessed, and then you might get a conclusion that he makes when he says, I know, or I perceived, I finally figured this out. And you'll see those key words pop up every so often where he's actually made a discovery. And then God in this book, clearly, Solomon never lost track of God, which I have to confess I did not realize reading this thing through. I thought at some point in my life, I thought maybe he was a bit of a skeptic as he was going through this. But look at the references to God. And all you got to do is pull out your Bible, you know, just a computer Bible, just our concordance, and look through it. But look at the references he makes to God. You'll see that almost every chapter has multiple references to God, and right from the beginning to the end. Even when he's frustrated in chapter 1 about the wearisome task or the burdensome task that God has given us to work and work and work, he doesn't just call it from a humanistic perspective, well, why do we have to work? It's, why did we have to do this that God has had us do? God's made it this way, and he's trying to figure this out all the way through this book. So you'll see there's a reference in chapter 1. There's two of them in chapter 2. There's 1, 2, 3. There's at least 3, maybe more, 4 or 5 there in chapter 3. Chapter 4 doesn't have one, but 5 does again, in multiple ones. Chapter 6 got references to God. You'll see right through the book, chapter 7, there's 4 references. 8, there's 4 more. Chapter 9, not 10, and we'll have a look maybe at why there. And then 11 and 12. And right through this book, it's pretty consistent when you look at the references. And they're not just bad references about God. He's trying to figure out what God is doing. And that impressed me to realize he never lost track of God was in control. He's not one of these kind of people today that's a real scientist type person who loses track of God and they have a humanistic view of life and they don't see God in it at all. Solomon really believed in his heart that God was always in control. He's just trying to understand, what is God doing? Why are we going through all this? And how can it be right in relation to the righteousness of God? If you're wondering about the passages about you and your, you'll see that there's the references. You'll see a lot of them. Chapter 5's got a bunch. Chapter 7 has 2 sections where he switches from the third person into the you and the your. Chapter 8's got one at the beginning. 9's got another one. 10's got a couple places. And then 11 and 12, right at the end of the book, become very personal, where he starts throwing out exhortations, especially to you young people over there. Now he wakes you up and says, in case you missed this, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, so you don't lose track of this. And chapter 11 at the end of the chapter does this a lot and wakes up all of us. So you'll see that he appeals to all of us at that point. Now, when you try to go back and figure out what frustrated Solomon, as you're going through the book, you're going to notice he's very frustrated. He's a frustrated person. Here he is, the king of a huge kingdom at this time. He's got all this power, all this wealth, all this wisdom, and he can't understand why life is the way it is. What is God doing? So he sets out to try to find the purpose of life in this world as God's doing it. He's trying to understand what God is doing with us. He witnessed the fact that death comes to everybody, and it really bothered him whether you were good or bad. And you'll see this comes up more than one time in this book, and it seemed unfair to Solomon. Now, when you look at why that happened, it could be a reaction to some of the Proverbs. I started wondering about that, about whether he simply had misread his own Proverbs. And we'll look at that at one point later on. And then he came to realize, from a human perspective, what he comes to as you're going through the book is he finds out that although life is unfair, he starts to, at one point, come to realize that, wow, God uses that unfairness. This is actually part of God's plan. He didn't want it to be fair and equal because he's using unfairness to test people in this life. That's what he's doing. And he actually comes to that realization finally on, where God uses it to try to figure out what makes us tick. Why are we serving God? Why are you here today? Why did you come? Why do you go to meeting on Sundays? Why do we go through life? Why do we do the Bible readings at home? Why do we do all these things? And God needs to figure out what makes us tick, because he's offering eternal life. And so Solomon finally comes to realize that, wow, one of the ways God finds out is by throwing unfairness right in our faces and make us deal with it. And how do we deal with it when it happens to us? And that's one of the things he looks at. And I tell you, I didn't realize that going through Ecclesiastes. He also realized finally that all the wisdom that you might have, it really can't empower you to understand God, because his ways are beyond our ways. And he comes to realize that at some point. He finally just spells it out later on in the book. And he finally says that even though he's got all this wisdom, and he might have figured out a few of the things that God is doing, it's almost impossible to actually look at your whole life and understand everything God did in your past and realize what's happening in your future as to what God is doing at the time. You just can't do it. And so what are you left with other than faith and trust? You have to believe. And this is what God is after. He's trying to develop children who believe him, who trust him, who have the faith to realize that whatever he does is right. Whatever he does. And this is what Solomon finally came to. And these are the kind of things I found really fun in this book, to see when that revelation, the light bulb goes on in his head, and he realizes, wow, there's an answer to one of those issues he was working over. So he starts out in chapter 1. We'll try to look at that this morning here in this first class. And he looks at, in chapter 1, as he's frustrated as he becomes, he looks at the cycles in chapter 1. We just read through these things. The vanity of vanities, as he started out. All this stuff is vanity when he looks back over all the work that he's been doing, all the stuff that he's trying to accomplish. And he looks back that he was just striving after when and what he was trying to find in this life. What he did is he presented four cycles. I don't know whether you realize that reading through there, but in chapter 1, there were four of them. You can just look at that. Verse 4 is one of them. One generation passes away, and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. Now, I know we quote that verse a lot to show people that the earth will abide forever, and that's what we use it for, but that's not why he used it. What he used it for is to look at the endless cycles God has set up. A new generation of kids comes in the couch right now. You have a new generation, and an older generation passes away. And Solomon was watching this and seeing his own dad die off and his dad's generation. And he watches the new ones come in, and another generation comes. And he realizes this has been going on for years, but you're still here. Nothing changed. And he's looking at the fact, what did it accomplish? See, he's answering this question of what profit is it? And that's what he's trying to figure out. We're going through all this work, and even the earth is going through all this work, and it's going through all these different things. What's the point of it? It just seems to go through cycles. So he goes to the sun. He says, look, the sun comes up. Now, if you live in California, you can see the sun come up. I don't know around here whether you actually get to see it very often, but we see the sun in California, and it comes up. I tried to bring it with us in the plane, but it didn't fit. And you try to bring some sunshine, because originally you saw the forecast for today. It was supposed to be all clouds today, and we didn't know if we'd see the sun all weekend. But he sees the sun come up every day, whoops, over in the east, and it sets in the west, and then tomorrow just goes through the same thing over and over again. And it's like God set up these cycles, and they just go through their work over and over again, and what do they accomplish? It's like nothing gets done. It's just an endless cycle that does nothing. All it does is come up every day and go down. And he's frustrated at the fact that it doesn't get anything done. And from his perspective at this point, he's looking at it from his perspective there, that it doesn't get anything done. He looks at the wind whirling around. Now, sometimes you look at the wind. We got windmills now. You can see sometimes the wind does accomplish things. It spins those turbines and generates electricity. But in his day and age, the wind would blow and it would blow. And it's like, it just keeps blowing. It comes out of nowhere and it just keeps blowing around. It must go back somewhere and starts all over again. And the wind just keeps blowing. And what does it get done? It's just running through endless cycles. And then he goes on and has a look at the rivers the same way. The water comes down and it just pours down, runs into the rivers. The rivers run into the sea. And it's like, well, what did they get done? They just start all over tomorrow and you get more rain. It comes down and starts all over again. Now, he wasn't looking at things like New York City and what we've seen in the last few days of what water can do. But he's looking in general at the cycles. And he's frustrated at the fact that he looks at the natural cycles like this and figures like, when they're all done, what did they get done? What did they accomplish? And this is from the perspective of a man who's building the temple, and then he builds his own house, and then he fixes the Milo, he fixes the wall of Jerusalem, and he builds and he builds and he builds, and he sees things being produced. This is the kind of man that Solomon was, and he's analyzing life, trying to figure out what's the point of all this. So there's all this labor, there's all this work going on, labor and labor. And he gets to verse 8, he says, all things are just full of labor. We're just like, even in the natural cycles, the earth's going through all these things, and it's just working and working. That man cannot express it in verse 8. It's almost like you can't find the words to tell it all. That's actually what he's getting across. And in our English versions, it doesn't read that way all the time. But he says, first of all, you can't find the words to explain it all. And secondly, your eye can't see it all. The eye is never satisfied with seeing. See, this verse is not about the desire of the eyes. That's what all the Hebrew people tell you right away. They say, that's not about the desire of your eyes can't see enough and the desire, and the way we use the passage today. What Solomon is frustrated at is that you can't vocally say enough words to describe all this going on. Your eyes can't see it all. The eyes are never satisfied with seeing. Like, you can't really see it all. And the ears, you can't even hear it all. Somebody can't tell you. When you listen to the news, you can't take it all in. And this is what he saw about life. This was his perspective on what's going on with all the work going on in life. There's so much labor, so much work, even in the natural world, all this is happening, you can't take it all in. And yet, what does it accomplish? What does it actually do? And he starts out, this is the beginning of his quest to try to figure out what is this all about? All this work that's going on. Endless labor everywhere. Now, you know that those of you who look at politics, you see that constantly it's just like there's really nothing new in politics. And this is how Solomon saw life. You go through these cycles and cycles and cycles, and what's really new? A new politician comes along, and really all he ever does is resurrect old stuff. They really don't come up with anything new. And all of you that are school teachers, you all know that in education, nobody creates anything new. They just put a new label on it, and they sell it to you, and you have a meeting about it, and they try to tell you, we're going to try this new stuff this year. And you're sitting there thinking, oh yeah, I saw that 20 years ago. And that's the way life is. And the workforce is probably the same way. See, Solomon analyzed all those things. He thought about life deeply and tried to figure out, what are really people really have that's new? They really don't have new strategies. You really don't have new stuff. All we do is recycle it. And if you think it's new, that's because you can't remember when we used it before. And that's what he says right here in chapter 1. Anything that anybody thinks is new, well, that's just because you don't remember it before. Or it's enough time has gone by to where you don't even realize. So he says, look in verse 10, is there really anything of which it may be said? See, this is new? Well, it's already been in ancient times before us. And there's no remembrance of the former things, and nor will there be any remembrance of the things that are to come by those who will come after. So this frustrated him because he was a building person. He was like looking for new stuff in life. He was the kind of person that got excited as a young man, thinking he was going to conquer the world and build all this stuff and do all these things in his kingdom. only to find out that, wow, there were really limits on this. You really can't do a lot of new stuff. You really can't produce what he had hoped for. And as he goes through this, by the time he gets finished, he starts looking at it from God's perspective more and realizes that, wow, it's not really about what did I get done. It's really more about what God's doing in us. And I found that really fun to see in Solomon as he grew and matured and finally came to realize that. So all those things that we think are really new, all they really were was just revisiting the past and doing all over again. So what's the profit then of all of our labor? What do we really get? And he realizes that we really don't accomplish much in life. It's all going to be soon forgotten. He laments because it seems to be a waste of time. It's a bunch of vanity. Like, why did we even do it? If you finally look at life that way and you stand back for a minute, then you wonder, like, well, why do we bother going through it? What's the point of all this work? Why do we go through all this effort if it really isn't going to accomplish much? And so as a real enthusiastic person, he really sets out to do this. Now, you guys know that you look at people today and you realize he's right. Some of you sitting in the audience recognize the pictures. Other people, a new generation comes along and some of these kids grow up and you ask them, like, well, who's that guy up there in the left corner up there? What in the world is he doing? And they look at that like, I don't know. And for some of us here, that was a big event in your life. You know, some of you remember that. And this is the way life goes. And it only takes 50 years. And all these things that were so important to us, they're gone. And people have forgotten them and moved on to something else. And those things that seem to be so important at that time are just forgotten and they pass away. And then something new. Oh, well, all it really is something old. And it revisits itself. This is what happened. And he finally sat back and realized it. Now, he's doing this as a young person. This is the problem when you have too much wisdom and too much time to think about it. He did. He tried to figure all this stuff out. So what's the profit then from all this labor? And he didn't realize yet that the goal of this life was that God was training us. That's going to come, but he didn't understand it right now, that God was using this to train his children. It's not about what we get done in life. It's about what God gets done in us. And I think you'll find as you come through this that you'll start to realize Solomon, finally the lights go on. And he realizes that, yeah, it really doesn't get anything done from a human perspective, but from God's perspective, it's getting a lot done. It would be like David out there taking care of sheep. And you wonder, like, why waste David's time taking care of sheep when he's going to be the king of Israel? But when he was taking care of those sheep, he was learning how to be a shepherd of Israel. And see, this is how God sees life. He trains us as we're going along for the jobs he has lined up for us in the future and even in the future age. And if you don't see it from that perspective, you just think, oh, it's a waste of time. Why do I do this? All the moms that are here, they're raising young children. You start to wonder, you have to give 24/7, 365 to that baby. And your whole life is taken up taking care of a baby. And you wonder, like, what are we doing? And it's going to go on then for years raising children. And what you find is that, wow, from a human perspective, that looks like a waste of time. Put them in daycare. Let somebody else take care of them. When you look at it from God's perspective, he's training you to work with people in the kingdom age. And what a great way to learn to do that, by raising your own children. You're learning how to be a family member of God's. And this is what he does. He trains people. And Solomon finally came to realize it as he was going through life. In fact, Paul actually mentions in Romans 8, he talks about the fact, because Paul, I think, had figured this out as well, that all of this vanity that the creation is going through, all of what we call this vanity in Romans 8, he says God subjected to this whole creation to vanity right from the day when Adam and Eve sinned and God changed our world and made it the way it is and put the curse on the ground. He subjected it to vanity in hope. In the hope. And the whole creation's been groaning and travail, going through all this work and this work and this work, because it's going to be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. Paul saw this as this was God's goal. He's using the experiences of this life to train his family. That's what God is really after. And so that's what Solomon finally came to. Be very similar to like Job. When you go back and look at Job's frustrations, you'll find out that Job became very frustrated with God. You find out that in Job 9, he says, very similar to Solomon, he says, look at, God destroys both the righteous and the unrighteous. It really doesn't matter what you do. God destroys both, the blameless and the wicked. Elihu brings this up later on in Job 34, and he says, look, Job, you said you're innocent, but God denies me justice. I am right. I'm considered a liar. Though I am guiltless, his arrow inflicts an incurable wound on me. What is a man like Job who drinks scorn like water? He keeps company with evildoers. He associates with wicked men, for he says, it profits nothing when he tries to please God. Profits a man nothing. This is the frustration Solomon had. He couldn't understand what God was doing, just like Job. So he just became frustrated in life. It's like, what's the point of it? It just doesn't seem to be any profit to it at all. And Job, we know, finally figured it out. Or very similar to what Christ said in Matthew 16. What profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and he loses his own soul? So what then Solomon will do then, he's going to go through these tests. And at the end of chapter 1, he runs the first test. Does wisdom bring profit? He's got all this wisdom that he can have, and he's trying to figure out, well, what if you have all this wisdom that God gives you, if you're like the wisest person on earth? Is this going to be a profit to you? Are you going to find satisfaction and happiness in all this wisdom? And so he tries to, at the end of chapter 1, he uses all his wisdom, and then he finds out that as he's gone through this in verse 14, I saw the works that are done under the sun, indeed it was all vanity, and just grasping for the wind. He gets very frustrated at the fact he can't fix all these things. Now imagine in his job as king, and people are coming to him, they got a baby, and they got a baby, and both moms say that that's their child. And he comes up with an answer for that one. Well, bring me a sword, we'll slay the baby. And he finds a way to solve that problem. Look at all the ones, though, he couldn't solve. All the crooked ways, he calls them. In verse 13, he says, look at what is crooked, in verse 15 there, cannot be made straight. And what is lacking cannot be numbered. He's frustrated that he can't solve all these problems in the kingdom. He solved some, but he couldn't solve them all. And later on, you'll find out that he refers to this later on in chapter 7. This is one of those learning experiences that he has. When by the time you get to chapter 7, he says, well, what God has made crooked, you can't fix. And he finally realized that God did it that way. And at this point in chapter 1, he hasn't seen that yet. But he's going to come to it at that later on in chapter 7. So we'll finish up with that one right now. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what's lacking cannot be numbered. You can't fix all these things. Well, when you get to chapter 7, he says, consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? And he realized God doesn't expect us to fix all those things. You can't fix all these people problems. You can't fix all these illnesses. You can't fix all these things because God is using them. He's using them to test people, to try to figure out what's your character like. Do you trust God? And he's going to use these things. And Solomon finally came to realize that by the time you get to chapter 7. So does wisdom bring profit? Well, he tries to analyze it, only to become frustrated in the fact that, look, it doesn't work that way. Instead, what he does then is he finds out the more knowledge you get, the more sorrow you get. And some of you know that as a person, that the more you come to know in life, the more frustrating life becomes. Because the more you know, the more you find out you don't know. And then you find out, look, you weren't even aware of things that you didn't even know about before. And that happened to Solomon. He finally came to realize that if you take all this wisdom and you think it's going to help you solve all these problems, all it really does in the end is frustrate you. Because now you're more aware of problems you didn't even know existed. You're more aware of ecclesial problems, of family problems, of all these different settings in ecclesial life, only to find out you can't solve them all. You can't figure them all out. And it frustrated Solomon to no end, the fact that he had all this wisdom and he couldn't fix all these things. And that's pretty much where he ends at the end of chapter 1. So we'll leave it there, have a little break time right now, and we'll pick up chapters 2, 3, and 4 in the next session. Thank you.